Well, after 18 months investigating the problem, Ross Garnaut has completed his review on climate change, and his final report has just been published as a book. It's available now through Cambridge University Press. It's a big read. Commissioned by the federal government, the Garnaut Climate Change Review examines the impact of climate change on our economy and environment, and it proposes a framework for an emissions trading scheme. One of Ross Garnaut's recommendations for Australia was a greenhouse gas reduction of between 5 and 10% by 2020. Now, he's been criticised by some for setting targets that are too modest, but Ross Garnaut believes setting higher targets for Australia will be ineffective unless an increased number of nations commit to binding targets. As we look toward the United Nations meeting in Copenhagen late next year, what are the chances of securing a truly global deal? And that's what we're going to pick out this morning and look at specifically. So to discuss the challenges of the coming year, and just before he hopped on a plane to Indonesia and then to Beijing, I welcomed Ross Garnaut to Saturday Extra.
Hello, Geraldine.
Now, Professor Garnaut, your final report was, of course, swamped by all the news of the last couple of weeks of financial turmoil. You're an economist. Are you optimistic that reforms will still progress in these enormous times of financial volatility?
Well, they should progress, Geraldine, but certainly the politics has become harder. Financial crisis is not an easy time politically to make major long-term structural reforms, but it's actually the right time economically. We've had examples of that before. I gave my report, Australia and the Northeast Asian Ascendancy, advocating removal of Australian protection to Prime Minister Hawke at the end of 89, and the government through 1990 was taking on board that, and then we fell into the recession that someone said we had to have. Hawke took the view against the opinion of the whole of the commentariat of Australia, that the depth of a recession, while it was the hardest time politically for a structural time, was the best time economically because you'd be shifting resources into the new activities as recovery began. And so it would be with climate change.
I just want you to develop a little bit more. How could you persuade people of that? Because it would seem like a double blow. Like you're saying it's particularly pliable at this time?
Yes, any large reform involving structural change, involving putting resources into new activities, in this case into the low emissions technologies in low emissions forms of transport and so on, requires investment. That is easier to manage as you recover from a downturn. It's perhaps counterintuitive, but that's the reality. There's another important point here, Geraldine, and that's that this is not a question of the environment versus the economy. There are very big environmental values at stake, but there are also economic values at stake. Climate change will damage the economy very, very severely if it's not mitigated, but it's long-term damage. And so the question isn't economy versus environment. It's the environment for sure, but it's also short-term economics versus long-term economics. And don't forget, it's short-term economics that got us into this financial mess.
Hmm. You're going to spend next week in Asia, I understand, and one of the concerns you have was that the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, and the famed Stern Review underestimated the growth in Asia and that was affecting their predictions. So do you say that Asia and its growth should be front and centre of discussions on climate change now?
Yes, that has to be the case. That comes out of the arithmetic. We've reworked all of the business-as-usual scenarios for growth in greenhouse gas emissions. What happens if nothing is done about it? And 90% of the growth between now and 2030 is in developing countries, most of it in Asia, first of all in China. If nothing is done about it anywhere, then by 2030 China will account for almost a third of global emissions, three times the United States. And so you don't deal with the problem unless you're talking about a global regime that includes the major Asian developing countries.
Your report also looks forward to a new international agreement, and hopefully one that emerges from the Copenhagen meeting. And you suggest that in an international agreement, nations could be divided into three groups. At the top of the income range, countries are subject to binding emissions commitments, and at the bottom, they're minimal commitments. And in the middle, countries would be subject to one-sided commitments, below business as usual, I think is the phrase you use. And this would apply to all except for China, which is what intrigues me. You're saying China is an exceptional case, are you?
Yes, simply as a matter of arithmetic, the global sums don't add up without China reducing the trajectory of its emissions growth. I'm not suggesting that a developing country like China, still with per capita emissions less than a fifth of Australia's per capita emissions, should accept the same kinds of constraints, but it needs to accept constraints. And I put a lot of effort in the review into defining a set of constraints on developing countries that add up to a global solution, but which are also manageable for the countries concerned. In China's case, that would involve holding emissions growth to half the GDP growth rate between now and 2020, and at a later stage, adopting more stringent trajectories.
Did you consult them in coming to these predictions or not?
Oh, I've been talking to senior Chinese about these matters since 1991, and I had several visits to China while I was working on this, and I'm familiar with the thinking of senior Chinese. I'm familiar enough to know that the idea of China accepting binding constraints is not welcome, but well enough also to know that it would be possible for them to accept the constraints I'm suggesting without damaging economic growth.
So your report says that China needs to be subject to binding emissions by 2013. So what I take it from your report, and I think this is the first time that someone's actually attempted to get into the Chinese realm and get into their heads and give them targets to work with, you think that by acknowledging their need to grow and yet setting some sort of target within that, you do at least meet some of the needs of their politics, I take it.
Yes, so what I'm suggesting is fully consistent with their delivering on what they say is domestic policy. China has a policy of hugely expanding renewable energy. They've got the world's largest wind energy program. They've got the world's largest solar program. They've got the world's largest nuclear program. They've got the world's largest biomass program. They've got the world's largest hydroelectric program. They're putting more emphasis on energy efficiency than anyone else. The imposts that they're putting on their high emissions industries like steel, aluminium and cement are considerably higher than those that we're placing, than we're talking about placing on our comparable industries under the emissions trading scheme. And so to some extent, what I'm suggesting they do is bind themselves internationally to what are domestic policies.
So then the question is how, I suppose, Ross Garnaut. I mean, it's incredibly difficult to get any sort of global agreement, and you make the case that if we have difficulty in trade talks when there's a lot of self-interest involved, why on earth will we in this? But, I mean, trying to reach an agreement that could affect them negatively is even more difficult, isn't it? How are you going to get the Chinese or any other developing nation, for that matter, on board?
I don't pretend that this is easy, Geraldine, and there are many, many barriers to an effective international agreement. But without such an agreement, we won't deal with the problem. And if we don't deal with the problem, the whole of the international community, including the developing countries we're talking about, face great risks. We've been talking about China. China would be very, very vulnerable to sea level rise. A lot of its modern industrial production is in the Great River Valleys or Great River Deltas the glacial areas, the ice and snow of the Tibetan Plateau and the Himalayas are the source of most of the world's great rivers. That could all be seriously disrupted by shrinkage of the glacial coverage of the Himalayas and the Tibetan Plateau. The Chinese scientists know that. You've got a similar worry about drying of the North China Plain, where 250 million people live, as we have about the drying of southern Australia.
So in other words, there is clear self-interest there as well, you're saying?
Yes. The trouble is that there's clear self-interest there as well as there is clear self-interest in Australia or America or anywhere else. And everyone also has an interest in free riding, in trying to get others to do the job. I've described this as a prisoner's dilemma problem. It's very difficult to break the prisoner's dilemma, where everyone's got an interest in shirking, although at the same time everyone's got an interest in an international agreement. You only resolve the prisoner's dilemma with communication, cooperation, side payments, and that's a process that I've sought to begin and take forward in the international chapters of the report.
Ross Garnaut, it's nothing if not your usual complexity. Very impressive. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Geraldine.
And Ross Garnaut is actually in Indonesia at the moment, on his way to Beijing next week. And that is now published by Cambridge University Press, Ross Garnaut's review on climate change. Now, just a couple of minutes for some of your letters. If I have time after eight, I'll do some more. Tony Kavanagh sent us a very quite heartfelt response to the financial crisis, because I asked for comments. Geraldine, I have been watching the unfolding crisis with a sense of schadenfreude until the 9th of October. I lost my life savings when I was caught up in the Icelandic banking crisis. I've been left with virtually nothing. This problem is not only affecting investors, it's also affecting people like me who have or had substantial offshore bank deposits. I'm staring bankruptcy in the face next year. I don't normally like talking about my personal finances, but I have found it therapeutic to talk about it. Simon Fole wrote to us too. I'm astonished at Lyric Hughes Hale, who was a guest last week talking about China just now, who claimed that the Chinese should be buying into the very system which we're all observing to implode because of the corrupt and utterly irrational way in which it operates. This, plus the idea that they should all be consuming more in the interests of improving things for us all. Is it not by now abundantly obvious that the buy, consume, waste mantra of the neoliberal ideologues is the primary driver of the current global problems? In any case, I'm sure the Chinese are in no danger of taking her advice anytime soon. And look, there are more along those lines, and I'll try to do some later. I might add, we've also been invited to contribute by the government to thoughts about public broadcasters. I'll give you the website after the news. Get your writing, your thinking caps on, till December to talk about how you think the ABC and the SBS should proceed.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.